Today is October 7th, 2015. This is the sixth and final interview with Kaya Rebena. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And I guess I'm talking soft, so let me just quickly check here. All right, I'm just going to have to speak up. So, Kaya, if you can help me out.
Do you want to move that closer to you?
Why don't we move closer to you also. Yeah, why don't you say your name and spell your last name, and then we'll figure out where to go from there.
Okay. Kaya Rebena, R-E-B-A-N-E.
Okay. Yeah, we're both soft. Closer to you. And then I'm just going to speak up there. Okay. Yeah, I'm just going to have to project a little bit. So, Kaya, you said there were some things in the, I guess, direct aftermath of the uprising that you wanted to come back to before we then finished up with some final thoughts and final questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just going to grab some water here.
Sure.
That'll be nice when ragweed stops blooming. So the one thing that happened right after the uprising, like in the month after the occupation ended, pretty much was there was a question. So there had been money raised for the occupation through a site called Defend Wisconsin. I think it was maybe defendwisconsin.org, although I actually don't really remember, but it was Defend Wisconsin regardless. And folks from the TAA had set up that website, but then it functioned as a general purpose, hey, support the occupation by donating here. So people from all over the place were donating from across the country and beyond were donating through that site. And we were all kind of promoting it, like, hey, if you want to support the occupation, here's where you go. After the occupation ended, there was, of course, then the question of what to do with the money, because the occupation was no longer going on. That was, you know, technically what it had been raised for. More or less, it was raised for the uprising or for that. And I know, like, I looked back at my email last night, and on March 4th, which was actually the day after the occupation ended, the question came up on an email thread that I was on, and so it arose pretty much immediately. And there was also the question of what to do with continuing in-kind food donations. So that was an additional sort of related thing where people were still, you know, we still had food coming in from local businesses. And it was like, well, the occupation is over, but how can we use this to support the ongoing efforts? So providing it to people phone banking or providing it to people at rallies, that kind of thing. But then on that thread also, I kind of spoke up and said, hey, it was important when, you know, the question of the money specifically, it was important that I thought that the group that was deciding what to do with that money, it was important that that group include people from the broader community of those involved in the uprising and not just the TAA, even though I'm a TAA member. You know, that was my main identity, but still, that was my feeling. And also, like, Charity Schmidt, whom I've mentioned before, also was, like, a strong advocate for this. The process, we had some back and forth, and one meeting that I believe Harriet Rowan chaired in the Ratzkeller at one point, but there was some back and forth, and I would say it was a bit of a contentious process. I, you know, can't speak to the details at this point, or maybe I, but regardless, it was, there were some feelings, because I think the TAA folks, some of them wanted to use it for some things and say, well, we should, you know, we're going to be losing dues money and things, and we may need it for that stuff, and it's like, whoa, no, you know, this is not just for the TAA. The TAA probably should have a part of it, certainly, and probably a reasonably large part, but it shouldn't just be the TAA. So anyhow, Charity and myself, at least, were definitely promoting, like, hey, we should really have some kind of democratic decision-making process that involves people not just in the union to figure out what to do with it. I can't remember exactly how the decision of what to do with it was made. I think it might have actually been the TAA's executive board that finally kind of made a decision. I don't think I was part of that decision. That's why I'm thinking that might have been how it went. But anyway, the final decision was to have the TA manage the money and accept proposals from outside groups to fund. And that's how it ended up being used. And I don't know how long that pot of money actually lasted. It was a good chunk from our perspective. I forget how much it was, but it was enough to have people argue over, I guess. And then they would take proposals and fund different things related to the occupation. There was that. And by the end of March, I think that was pretty much resolved. I mean, the funding hadn't been dispersed yet, but for the most part, but it was, we'd figured out what to do with it. But I remember a period of what seems like a long time, but it probably wasn't more than, you know, those few weeks, kind of going back and forth in this being a thing. In terms of the aftermath of Act 10, I mean, the TA was facing much the same as the other public employee unions in the state, although I think we did a bit better than a number of them just because of our culture of organizing, which a number of the unions didn't have as much. They had more of a culture based on providing services rather than organizing. So we did a bit better in that way, but we also have a fairly transient membership where people come and go a lot, and we aren't all in the same building, so that made it harder for us. I mean, the things that were really huge, I think, and I wasn't at that point in the leadership of the TAA, so, but we definitely had, the inability to do payroll deductions was a big thing. Before we could have somebody sign up to be a member and the university would deduct the dues from the payroll, we couldn't do that anymore. And so you had to ask people for their bank account information. And then at some point it became possible also to use a credit card, which personally I was much happier about because I was very nervous about the bank account just for me personally, because there are times that I'm not confident I'll have enough money to have a regular deduction, and it makes me nervous to have regular deductions being taken out because I can end up with, you know, problems. And I assume I'm not the only one in that situation. But this was harder, though, because you're asking people for their account information or their credit card number, and people may not want to give that. There was also, of course, the issue of not having fair share anymore. So that was huge, not having everybody that was covered by, well, a contract anyway, paying their fair share to bargain that contract. Now, the contract also ended up going away because there was also an annual recertification requirement to even have a contract, and you couldn't really bargain over much of anything anymore. Like, they'd taken away pretty much everything, or virtually everything you could actually bargain for. So the whole package together is essentially, made it very hard to organize. And so the TA decided not to try to recertify. We decided not to jump through their hoops of, you know, having annual elections so that we could bargain over virtually nothing, and instead to focus on organizing and focus on other types of action and talking directly with the UW administration about moving forward on certain things there, because a lot of our interests align with the administration, actually having good wages and good, you know, benefits and things like that helps with the UW being competitive and recruiting, you know, the best graduate students and that kind of thing. So that's important, and it also helps with completion. So that's important from the UW's perspective, although certainly our interests as workers do not always align with the administration, hence why, you know, having the ability to bargain is really actually very important. But unions existed before collective bargaining, and, you know, they can exist without it. It's just that it does make some things harder. Our membership base declined a decent chunk. It used to hover somewhere in the vicinity of about 2,000 roughly members out of, and then about 3,000 people paying dues? Now I'm forgetting the numbers, but roughly out of our bargaining unit of TAs and PAs. And it dropped to 600 or something in that general vicinity. And there was organizing going on and all, but it declined quite a bit. It didn't decline as much as some others, like the State Employees Union was always, I remember before Act 10, at our state AFT state conventions, they were always kind of the big dog and, you know, really had the most sway in terms of membership numbers, the most votes and all that. And they were just decimated because they tend to work in different buildings that are very spread out, and it just ended up being very hard for them to maintain their membership numbers. And so they really just, their numbers took a real nosedive. And so did, I mean, all of our numbers took a nosedive, I would say, pretty much. There were some public employee unions that certainly managed to hold on to contracts longer than others, some which had more favorable organizing conditions. Some of the teachers' unions were able to, you know, they have whole buildings full of their potential members, and it's easier for them to walk around and talk to each other and things like that. So the conditions of individual groups of workers had quite a bit to do with how well they did after Act 10, but it definitely made things much harder for all of us, no question. We ended up having to lay off our staff and cut expenditures in general. We didn't have the same sort of budgets for meetings and things as we did before. And it was just generally that stuff is bad. Now, there's a little bit of a, I don't know if I want to call it a silver lining, but I guess a little silver lining where it did make it more important to focus on organizing and other types of action, because sometimes, you know, you can get a little complacent with that kind of thing. And like I said, our union, just because of our high turnover and I think of our general culture. Otherwise, we have always focused quite a lot on organizing. Mm-hmm. But you know, we kind of stepped that up, and other unions definitely, there was a lot of discussion in the aftermath among labor folks and union leaders about how do we refocus more on organizing and what sorts of actions can we do and what, you know, how can we use our collective power to benefit everybody's working conditions, et cetera? How can we work better with community members that are not in organized labor? How can we do all these things to advance our interests and move everything forward when we have been taken, so many of these rights have been taken away from us, and so many things that we used to be able to rely on, we cannot anymore. So there was definitely a lot of soul searching, for sure, and some real serious impact as well, which we're still seeing the aftermath of that kind of still develop, since some unions had been able to had managed to get contracts approved before all this was finalized, and so they were able to kind of delay some of the effects. But yeah, and one effect that, I mean, it wasn't entirely just an effect, but one thing that had something to do with Act 10, I think, was so the two state teachers unions, WEAC, which is the Wisconsin Education Chief Council. I can't remember what that means. I do know that. My mind's just going blank right now. And AFT, which is the American Federation of Teachers, Wisconsin, they considered merging. And this wasn't the first time this had been considered. There had been previous times in previous decades when the question of merger had come up, and there are other states where this had happened. So there are good arguments potentially for merging that are not just based on Act 10. But I think that some of the immediate reason for considering this now was because of that. So there had been a committee that the two unions put together called the Unity Committee that had started meeting shortly before our AFT Wisconsin convention, whatever year that was, and now I'm forgetting if it was, it would have been fall, it's probably 2000, it was either 2011 or maybe 2012 by that point. I'd have to look, I'm not sure. But maybe 2012, I'm not sure. But anyhow, they had started some very preliminary discussions, and then there was a resolution at the state convention that Greg George, who's the head of the Wisconsin employees, WEPEC, the Wisconsin Public Employees Council? Jeez. WEPEC, anyway, had kind of put forth, and I and others from the TA also were, supported, which called to expand that committee to represent each one of the AFT councils of employees, so basically every kind of type of employee in these categories that we have. And so that passed, and then I was asked to serve as the grad employee rep, possibly because I was, pushing forward at convention, although I don't know. But regardless, I was asked to serve as the grad employee rep, and I said sure. And so that was, I can't remember exactly how long we met. I want to say it was about a year, maybe a little longer, but about a year probably, of weekend-long meetings about, I think maybe once a month or something like that, maybe a little more. And so most of them were in Madison. Some of them were in other places in the state. And we'd just sit in a room for, 2 days straight with with two facilitators, one from NEA and one from AFT National, and just work on structure and, dues, conversations, and all the rest. And eventually we developed a proposal which went to both, went to both of the memberships of both unions. And we ended up rescheduling the AFT Wisconsin convention to be close to the time that the NEA one, I think. Is that right, or did we vote on it before? I think we rescheduled it to be in the spring, but now I'm having trouble remembering. Regardless, what ended up happening in the end was that although AFT members ended up supporting it, as I recall, WEAC members decided they needed some more time and wanted to think about it more or whatever. And I think part of that, I wasn't in that process because I'm not a WEAC member, but my understanding was that probably had something to do with the fact that they were already undergoing quite a substantial reorganization at the time, where they were consolidating some of their regional areas and kind of renaming them and reshuffling staff and doing various different things. And so I don't know whether, it may be that we still will merge. I don't know. I haven't heard of anything about it really recently. Our AFT Wisconsin convention is coming up this month, so I'll probably hear more there if I go. But Yeah, so that was a process that we went through and certainly looked seriously at merging, and we may still do so, I don't know. I mean, other unions in Wisconsin have sort of gone through, I suspect, something similar. At least I know AFSCME, the three AFSCME councils merged about 5 or 6 months ago or whatever that was. So, yeah, so we'll see what happens with that. But I think it's definitely something that has inspired a lot of Act 10 in general, a lot of questioning and soul searching in the labor movement and trying to figure out how to deal with a new reality where, you know, we were such a strong union state with quite a lot of rights that frankly a lot of other states had already lost or didn't have, some, you know, a lot of the southern states and what have you, and then suddenly boom, we have to actually deal with this, and how do you organize in this new environment? And I think everybody's agreed that we should and we can, and you know, we can do it. It just, you have to figure out how, because it's a new situation that you didn't have from all those years when your union culture was kind of developing and sort of you know, getting in place or whatever. Should I go on the sing-along?
Yeah, I mean, sing-along, or, I mean, we could pay this forward to Right to Work, since it somewhat relates, and then go back to the sing-along.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, so the Right to Work legislation, which is, I mean, we, Act 10 was very close to Right to Work for the public sector. So the Right to Work legislation was basically about not allowing fair share, not allowing a requirement that all union members pay, or sorry, that all workers in a bargaining unit pay their fair share for negotiating a contract that would benefit everybody, and but specifically for the private sector. And that all went down in, I think, around February of this year, 2015, somewhere. I'm not sure if it started in January, but regardless, I think it was all February. And I mean, that was a much shorter process in the then Act 10, you didn't see the sort of huge uprising come out of that. And I remember a number of people in some, you know, the rallies and stuff that were being held kind of lamenting that, or feeling like, oh man, you know, everybody seems so kind of down and dejected and like the fight's gone out of them or whatever. And I mean, there's probably various reasons for that, and partly has to do with, I think, how the private sector unions were handling things. But regardless, I think it's also just that there have been a good number of people who have interpreted the uprising as like, well, this huge thing happened and yet, you know, we didn't win. While I think there's a lot of arguments to be made for that it did actually have an impact, although obviously it didn't go the way that we had hoped. But there was a public hearing for the Right to Work legislation, which went on for, I think, just several hours in a day. And I had to actually work that day. So I left and went to sign up like to testify, but it was gonna be like at the end of the day. So I didn't actually get over to the room until relatively late, and I put my name down. And the hearing ended up wrapping up earlier than, I don't know that I necessarily would have gotten a chance anyway if they'd ended on time. There was a question of when they were gonna end, but they called it off early. And actually, let me step back a little. So there had been a number of folks from different unions, and mostly different unions, that had planned like an action. I don't remember the details of what it was anymore, but something basically at the end of the day for when that hearing, when they were going to try to close it down or whatever. So we had planned something, and I think word got out about that. And the Republicans reacted, claiming like an actual physical threat. Like that was their claim. They actually shut the hearing down before the scheduled time. And their claim was, well, this is like, there's a threat to our safety, and so we have to like leave. But then they were the only ones who, like, they basically, I think they had police come in and escort them out, although I'm forgetting that exactly. But they definitely, the Republican members of the committee left the building. but they didn't evacuate, like, you know, if there was actually a threat, you would think they might evacuate the member of the public or the Democrats or something else. So pretty clearly that was, you know, even if the story had gotten twisted, it didn't seem like they actually thought it was a threat that was a violence. It was more just like, oh, this is a threat of something that might make it look bad, probably, or otherwise something we don't want to deal with. So anyway, so that didn't go quite as according to plan. I mean, a lot of people testified against this. There was quite a, you know, decent turnout for that anyway, and I think, based on what I understood, you know, almost all were opposed to it, right? And then, so the next day, then the Senate was debating the legislation, or kind of debating, discussing anyway. I think, actually, no, they were debating because some of the Dems were standing up and speaking out against it for sure. And so some of those of us who had met previously to discuss that previous action got together and said, well, you know, what can we do to at least make it clear that not everybody's in favor? Frankly, we're not. Many people aren't in favor of this, and at least take some kind of stand on this. And so we decided to have a few people like stand up and disrupt, like in the Senate chamber, to stand up and speak out loud to, you know, stop the debate. And for a few, not very long, obviously, because you immediately get escorted out, but to at least say that we thought this was wrong. And so I was one of the ones that did that. And there were a few others too. I know Randy Bryce did, and a few others that I'm forgetting who, Mike Rosen from AFT Local 212 also, I think, and some others. So anyway, and I tipped off my boyfriend, who's a photographer, that, hey, something's going to happen in the Senate chamber, because there was a rally going on outside too at the same time. And it's like, hey, something's going to happen. You should probably go and, you know, see if you can get into the photography area. And he did that. So, so I got some photos of that and, you know, kind of did some social media stuff publicizing what had happened. But honestly, you know, that was I think we all knew that was a losing fight. We weren't hoping to really stop. I mean, we would love to have stopped it, but it was one of these things where the train's leaving the station. You don't have any control over it, but you at least want to get on something on the record that the people of Wisconsin don't support this. Because frankly, most people didn't support this. And our elected officials were acting like, I don't know, they've been acting like they're not accountable at all to, you know, the public of Wisconsin, which is probably a large part because they're not really, because they, you know, are more accountable to their big donors than they are to the actual people who elect them, which is not the way it's supposed to work. But that's how it's been working recently in Wisconsin. So anyway, I remember like the mood of that whole, the whole right to work thing, like I already said, being kind of not so peppy. And like I made a sign for it, like the one, like it was, I put on there, I tried to come up with something that was like actually like, hey guys, keep fighting. It's always darkest before the dawn, keep fighting, with like the Wisconsin Blue Fist. And I had a lot of people come up and say, oh, I'm so glad to, you know, see something that's sort of optimistic and whatever, and okay. You know, so, but it's it was definitely kind of a little depressing. So should I go back to the sing-along?
Yeah, or do you have any questions? Let's move to the sing-along.
Okay. So the sing-along, like I said earlier in a different interview, I wasn't involved in like the early part of the sing-along. I mean, not really. I went a few times and sang, but I definitely wasn't going regularly or any kind of playing any key role or anything like that. But I mean, I knew they were singing and I supported them doing so, and I was glad they were kept going and kind of, you know, keeping it up and not just allowing, after Act 10, just going away and melting away. You know, I was glad somebody was in there, as the sing-along participants like to say, singing truth to power. And they kept doing it regularly. And so then in 2013, in July 24th, actually, 2014, and I know that because we had an event that day, I was actually in the Capitol as doing a press conference with a coalition called MOVIE, Money Out Voters in Wisconsin, which I've been involved with on the part of South Central Wisconsin Move to Mend and Wisconsin Move to Mend at the time. And so I was involved there helping to run that, whatever, and just kind of along with a bunch of other people, not just me. And I think that we were making an announcement about some legislation Chris Taylor was introducing, if I recall correctly. But regardless, we had this press conference. And after the press conference, we had a couple of guys, among other press, that were there from the Devil's Advocate radio show. And when we all left, I mean, I had somewhere to be, and so I just kind of went down and went out the building. I didn't go through the rotunda, but the Devil's Advocate, those two guys, went like the route that went through the rotunda. And the sing-along was happening, and they stopped and watched, and I think one of them might have been singing or something, and the other one was like watching. And that's the day that the crackdown on the sing-along happened, because they were there. And so that, I remember that, even though I wasn't there, I remember because, you know, that's why they were there. And the cops just, you know, the Capitol Police just it was a crackdown that they just started arresting people for being there, essentially. And I forget the justification at the very beginning there, but I remember very clearly feeling like outraged when I basically got home and then saw this had happened. I was just like, this is not okay. You know, this is, I mean, I felt like, I mean, we've seen from history recently in Wisconsin and, you know, more older history as well, that if you let governments take away some of your rights, they tend to keep taking away your rights. And so it's not really generally a good idea to let them have any of them, because a lot of times they don't really know where to stop, right? And even though singing in the Capitol is something that most people won't do, free speech is actually really important, and that's supposed to be protected because that is a public forum in the Capitol that's defined that way. And to have the Wisconsin state government, Walker and others, and the police chief basically say, no, we're just tired of hearing you guys, so we're going to not let you do this anymore, I thought was really inappropriate. And the sing-along is specifically at the noon hour so that it doesn't, I mean, it's held then so it doesn't actually disrupt meetings and other things. It's like basically over the lunch hour. So yes, can you hear it in some of the offices nearby? Yes. But it's at a time where it shouldn't be disrupting normal business, right? So anyhow, so I felt like I needed to go and, like, you know, stand with the rest of the sing-along participants. And I mean, I wasn't the only one. I mean, the next day, of course, pretty predictably, you had a whole lot more sing-along participants there because all of us had heard about that and we said, no, this isn't okay. So I was there the next day, and for many of the days in the next few weeks, I had a bit of a lull in my work schedule. My work schedule fluctuates a bit at my job, and so I was able to, like, I was working off campus by that point, and so I was able to be there because we didn't have a lot that I had to be in the office for, so I made it a habit to generally go at the noon hour unless I had something else I had to do. And I mean, that first day, like, I mean, I took different signs practically every day, just because I don't know, in part, to be honest, because I wanted photographers who were also going to have something to photograph, and, you know, the more visual material you can give people, the more likely it is that your story will get out. So the next day I had a sign that said, money is not speech, but singing sure is, and then I kind of kept scratching out new signs, but, like, usually right before I left for the sing-along and taking them along. And one of those, actually, I remember that one of them got circulated a decent amount, which is, when money talks but people are silenced, the system is broken, and that one, you know, was one that got some social media sharing, so that felt good about that. But we got our message out, you know, and a lot of support ended up kind of coming our way from different areas of the country and, you know, personal contacts and all. Just about everybody, at least everybody in my own social circle, was supportive. You know, people generally were like, this is, what they're doing is not okay. How dare they? You know, free speech is our right. You know, you should absolutely be able to be there. Thank you for what you're doing, etc. And, like, one of my, I mean, I had a couple conservative friends actually comment on the what was going on, and basically they were supportive and saying, like, one of my friends was like, you know, I would be there with you if I was actually living in Wisconsin. Like, I would totally be there with you. Like, this is important to stand up and protect this, and what have you. And this is that was like a friend that we also agreed on things like the money out of politics things. It's one of these things that sometimes you don't see eye to eye on a lot of political stuff because you're of rather opposite political persuasions, but there are some areas of common ground. And on the idea of getting money out of politics, amending the U.S. Constitution to make clear that corporations and unions and what have you are not people, and that money is not speech, that's something conservatives and progressives generally do agree on. And this thing in the Capitol with the solidarity sing-along and having the right to be there was also something that, at least in my own personal social circle, was something that my conservative friends also agreed with. And granted, I have a lot more progressive friends than conservative friends, but I do have a few of both, and there was general agreement that what the Wisconsin state government was doing was not okay. Let's see, so I got arrested in there twice. I mean, I didn't go wanting to be arrested, but I went realizing that I could be, of course, because, I mean, part of it, the idea of having a bunch of people go is it makes them harder for them to silence the people that are there by arresting them and slapping fees on them and what have you. So I ended up getting picked up twice, and after the first time, and definitely after the second, I kind of learned that when I got there and I quickly, like, went into the inner circle of the sing-along, that it seemed like it was much less likely I'd get arrested, which is what I did from then on, because they tended, the cops tended to come and pick people out from like the very outer ring. Mm. So if you were in the middle, it was less likely that they'd get to you. So I admit that I started doing that because I didn't really want to get, I mean, each of those citations was a couple $100 and I mean, if we had ended up paying them, and I just didn't really, you know, they had threatened other types of charges and stuff. So both those times when I was arrested, I think I think the first two, I just, you know, kept singing after. I mean, a lot of us did when they would put the handcuffs on you. You just keep singing as you were being let out, you know, just to basically say you can't silence us that way. The second time there was actually, we all ended up taking, I mean, we're generally taken down to the basement for processing anyway, most of us. And that was true for both times that that happened to me. The second time I was down there with quite a good number of people, and they'd separated the women on one side and the men on the other side. And among the women, I forget who else was there, but I remember the woman Kimi and my friend Adrian Padgett was there as well. And we were all singing, and there was this young, very nice actually, seeming like DNR warden who was there. And I don't know if that was his first time there or what, but he was very chatty, and I don't generally like to, I don't, you know, talking too freely with any cop when you're in custody, even if they seem nice, is not generally a good idea. So I didn't really make a lot of small talk with him, but he seemed very like straightforward and nice and just kind of like friendly and all the rest. But after we were released, like processed and released, one of the women, Kimi, I guess she had noticed during when we were down there that he was taking video, because we were all singing. We were all sitting down there and we were all singing. And the men were singing over on that side, the women were singing, and we were doing some call and response sort of things and singing. And so, anyway, so that was, so she got this video, and that's like out there online somewhere. And that was, I thought, actually a really powerful experience, because it's like you're getting, getting handcuffed, and I'm still singing and going down there. And then as I'm nearing the kind of basement, the doors to the basement kind of area under the rotunda, which is where they were processing us, I could like hear people singing as I was getting close to the doors. They opened the doors and it's just the song. And I felt like that was really powerful, that, you know, we just kept going and kept singing. And I don't know that the cops really appreciated it, most of them, although I think the DNR warden might have, he seemed like that might have been what was going on. But regardless, and we just kept going until, you know, they released us, and then that was it. But it really did kind of, there was a sense of power to it, I guess, and of being, as the Solidarity Sing-Along likes to say, unintimidated, which is a phrase that they adopted based on Walker's claim to be unintimidated, and he was coming out with a book to that effect, and then the sing-along was like, no, we think we're going to use this because we're the ones that are unintimidated, and, you know, managed to, I think, adopt that pretty effectively. I mean, I think that there's lots of reasons to say that Walker has not been very unintimidated. Maybe he has been unintimidated, I don't know, but he's done things that are kind of don't really point that way, but I think the sing-along definitely can claim that. So let's see. So
so have you continued to...
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, have you continued to go to the sing-along?
Not so much really recently, although I definitely have. I mean, now it's more that I'll meet up with sing-along, you know, folks now and again for different events, or sometimes I'll go, but the regular sing-along, I don't usually go at this point. And it's mostly just a matter that, that they're able to continue with what they're doing at the moment. I mean, there were various reasons for that, but, yeah, so I don't go regularly. I mean, honestly, I'm juggling a lot of things and taking off an hour every day to sing, although I enjoy doing it. It's difficult to fit into the schedule usually. But for quite a, you know, number of months, I was going regularly. And on Monday through Thursday, they had the sing-along in the Capitol, and then on Fridays, generally, would be outside. And on the days I was outside, I'd, like, bake Solidarity cookies and come and pass them out and stuff. And it was just it's a good group of people. Like, there's internal politics like there are in any group, but... it's a good group of people, and definitely made some friends with folks kind of that are sing-along regulars, and I really do value that.
And some of those folks are different than the folks that you had met and befriended during the uprising?
It's quite a different crowd, actually, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, there's some overlap, but most of them are pretty different. I mean, some of them I knew previously from different... Mm-hmm. places anyway, just because Madison's not really that big a town. Like, you tend to see some of the same people in different circles, but I would say it is kind of a different social grouping than most of the folks who were that I met during the uprising. But there were some, like, for instance, Charity, who I mentioned multiple times. Like, she was arrested several times. She'd come regularly, and she was arrested, I'm actually not sure how many times, but I know one time on her birthday for tapping her foot to the music, she was arrested, which is just ridiculous. And the Raging Grannies, who are, I know a number of through other, we worked together in a number of things before, like, they were arrested. And so, like, there were a bunch of people, especially during that crackdown kind of period. And there had been some kind of, I mean, it wasn't the first time that people had been harassed or arrested either. I mean, this was the one that I was involved with. And a lot of times when I'd, you know, kind of be going into the sing-along during that period when I was going regularly, I would go and drop, like, my bag off in a representative's office along the way or somebody, you know, and kind of just go. Because you knew that you might end up being detained or whatever, and I didn't really want to have my stuff with me for the most part. But, I don't know. Where was I going? I had a thought and it's gone. But, well, eventually, anyway, the charges were dismissed. It took quite a while. Both Charity and I had the same lawyer, actually, and he was working pro bono for us, which was very nice of him. But eventually the charges were dismissed, and happy about that anyway, because, I mean, they were bogus, I think, to begin with, but I don't want any charges. Like, that's obviously not something I'd want. There was one part of that story also, just on a personal level, that, I mean, I guess one good thing that came out of the sing-along for me personally was that at some point during that crackdown phase, I got a friend request on Facebook from a guy named Joe Bresky, and I mean, I didn't know who he was, so I just ignored it, because I usually ignore requests from people that I don't know, and I'll usually, like, kind of ignore them, and then every now and again I'll go and clear out all the ones that I haven't figured out who they are, and this was one of the ones I just ignored it, and it was like, whatever. And then after, I guess, a couple of weeks, I noticed that he actually was a photographer who had taken a bunch of photos, like, of me as well as other people in the sing-along and some of the arrest photos and stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, that's who that is. And so I accepted the request, and we messaged back and forth a bit. And he's one of the core people involved in the Overpass Light Brigade, which is another organization that arose during the uprising. I can talk a little bit about that if you want. But there was an OLB event at the Capitol, and my friend Jonquil had invited me to that. And that was the first one I'd ever been to, although I'd heard about them before. And so I went, and it was kind of dark, and because the OLB, it's a matter of holding these lighted letters up and spelling out different messages, which are then displayed in a way that passersby can see them, and also generally shared on social media. And Joe does a lot of that photography and sharing stuff, although he's not the only one. And anyway, so I was kind of like squinting around in the darkness, and I could see some photographers, and I recognized Leslie Peterson, who I know, and some other people, I think. But there was one guy, I was like, who's that over there? And whoever it was I was talking to was like, oh, that's Joe Bresky. And I was like, oh, you know, I'd like to actually meet him, because I've been messaging with him on Facebook. And so I asked to be introduced. And I went and, like, you know, introduced myself to him, and we decided to get lunch the next day so that we could kind of, like, get to know each other a little bit. And we ended up dating, and still together now, you know, a couple years after that or whatever. And also now I end up doing a lot of OLB stuff also because of that. But that, for just on a personal level, it's sometimes those kinds of, I don't know, like, who activism sometimes does lead to these personal relationships. Like, there's a couple friends of mine also who met years ago before the uprising in the TAA, and, you know, they're married and have a kid now and seem to be very happy. And so these things, and actually, I know a couple couples like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess on a personal level, taking a month or whatever out to go and sing and, you know, have handcuffs slapped on me a couple of times had some personal benefits, although I couldn't have predicted that at the time. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So I think I'm going to just quickly move on to some of the other stuff, kind of post that, unless you want to talk about the OLB.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the OLB, OLB, okay. And then...
OLB, yes.
Yeah, and then...
And then wrap it up.
Yeah, and then we'll go probably laundry list a little bit and then wrap it up.
Okay, sounds good. So, okay, the Overpass Light Brigade was started in Milwaukee by Lane Hall and his wife, Lisa Moline, who are professors at UWM. Wait, Lane is. Yeah, I think Lisa is too. I might be wrong, but I think so. But anyways, and they initially had a sign that Lane, I think, mostly made that said something about recalling Walker and in lighted letters, and it was all just one piece. And he used that during the uprising, you know, he'd go and, you know, hold it at protests and whatever. And then they were, I forget exactly how it transitioned, but they ended up transitioning to doing like a, making letters. There were individual letters and having different people hold them on a bridge. And I think it, and I wasn't involved at this point, so this is all secondhand. But I think part of it was that they initially tried to attach them to like the overpass on the freeway, like the chain link or whatever it was that was on there. And there's like legally you can't actually do that. And so, but it turns out you can if you have people hold them because it's not attached and that's okay. So then they would have, they kind of developed into this organization that would go out and hold these messages, usually related to various progressive causes and usually on overpasses, although not always. And fairly early on, within the first few months, Joe ended up joining up with them, and he ended up doing a bunch of the like photography and basically getting opening previously I think most people that would see this stuff were people that happened to drive under the overpass or what have you, and Joe does a lot of social media and he's really good at that, and so he ended up taking that and through the photography and through his social media skills pushing stuff out on social media, so I got a lot wider coverage. And at this point, I mean, the Overpass Light Brigade, they've there have been a number of other light brigades that have started after seeing this form of activism have started across the country and in other countries. There's a light brigade network now that's, I'm not sure the exact number of it, maybe 40 or 45 light brigades across the world, mostly in the US, but not all, only. There's also a few in Europe and Australia, I think, and some other places. And so so this is this you know, kind of tactic that ended up being very successful. And so it is still going strong right now. They do, you know, messages on different topics on a pretty regular basis. And some of them I have helped organize and plan to some degree, although the main three people that are, that I would say are the Overpass Light Brigade, mostly are Lane and Lisa and Joe, but then there's also this whole group of holders of the light who are all the people that come out and hold the messages. And that's obviously like a really key part as well. So they're really important as well. And so, yeah, and there's, it's kind of like a lot of the, there's a lot of like social ties between those people too. Like they identify as holders and will, it's a kind of a social event. We were out holding a letter on a bridge. You get to talk to the person next to you and you're out there for quite a while. So, it's kind of a cool thing. And there's within Madison anyway, the group of holders here has a lot of overlap with the Solidarity sing-along participants. It's not quite exactly the same, but there's a lot of overlap. So when, you know, there's, if either group has some kind of event, there will be kind of people that, there's a lot of people that they kind of share. So, yeah, that's also another thing that I guess came out of the uprising that is a positive thing and has, just to kind of jump ahead a little bit to the question of what sort of effects, I mean, that's a kind of artistic sort of form of activism that has really resonated, I think, in a lot of ways, and has formed some good bonds socially among people, as well as just been a way of getting the word out about lots of different issues. So let's see, I'll do a laundry list, I guess. Post that, there were a bunch of other things which I won't go into too much. I mean, personally, I ended up on the South Central Federation Labor, their Committee on Public, the Committee on Political Education for a while. So there was that. There was some stuff with the constitutional amendment fight. We ended up creating a state, Wisconsin Move to Mend organization at one point, and, you know, being, I mean, I've been co-chair of that for a while, so. And then recently we disaffiliated from Move to Mend and are starting to work towards creating a new national organization called United to Mend, and that's still in process and has not launched, and I don't know, you know, would have to check back with you to later if you are curious, but we're kind of working, a number of us have been working on that. I did a bunch of stuff also just personally on like climate stuff. I mean, there's, I played a role, although not the leading role, in forming the local 350 chapter, 350 Madison. Helped found a group to push for fossil fuel divestment at the UW called Fossil Free UW. We did some stuff, including getting, convincing the student government to call for fossil fuel divestment, and have done a bunch of other stuff. I also personally have spent a lot of time in the No KXL Pledge of Resistance effort, which is basically trying to get the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline to not be built, to get Obama to basically decline a permit for that. And I got involved in that in the summer of 2013 with a bunch of other people, trained over 130 people here in the Madison area in peaceful civil disobedience to like deploy if we need to. Hopefully we won't. And like we're still waiting on Obama to make a decision, so we're in a bit of a holding pattern. But so there's that. There was an event called XL Descent, which is also on tar sands, also on the Keystone XL in Washington, D.C., which I also helped coordinate logistics and trying to, that was a whole story that I won't go into, but there was a lot of logistical things that happened at the last minute and trying to get whatever it was, 35 or so undergrads mostly, you know, to D.C. when your bus fell through at the last minute and it was like blizzards and just, it was fun. But we all got there, we all got back, nobody was injured, it all worked out. I got reimbursed. I also was involved in like setting up a group called the WISE Alliance here in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Safe Energy Alliance, which is also focused on tar sands and trying to push back against tar sands expansion here in Wisconsin. There's also a Midwestern group that's sort of similar that I've been somewhat involved with. Went to the climate march in New York in last September, was it, I guess? So stuff along those lines. And there's probably stuff that I haven't mentioned, but just basically, I guess the only thing that's really important there is if anybody cares, I'm still doing activist stuff that isn't just labor, but, you know. So I could go on to how the uprising has affected me or how what have you, if you want me to. I know that you're wanting to not have this interview run too long, so I'm kind of watching
maybe
the
just
clock.
Maybe just one follow-up, yeah. And you've probably talked about this in one of the other sessions, but I guess the quickest way to say this is why this shift to climate change in terms of your activism?
I mean, personally, I think the bigger question for me is why I wasn't doing more on that to begin with, because that's the whole reason that I'm in grad school. That's the main concern I've had, you know, for quite a long time. And I think there just got to be a point when I kind of said, well, of all the things that I really should be working on, I mean, the thing I care most about is climate change. The thing I'm most concerned about, I should say, is climate change. I mean, the reason I care about climate change is because of other things, people, other creatures, et cetera. But yeah, there just kind of came a point when I honestly just said, well, I've been doing a lot of education stuff and labor stuff and what have you, and pro-democracy work, and that's all very important, but I want to actually do some stuff that's directly on climate. I mean, a lot of the constitutional amendment stuff I see is quite related too, because it's very hard to accomplish much of anything else when you've got, you know, money dominating our political process. But yeah, so I think it's mostly just that I kind of came to a point when I thought I actually want to do some stuff directly on the climate issue. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then,
and I thought the new KXL stuff would be over much quicker and wouldn't take this much time. I had no idea what I was getting into, although, I mean, I don't have any regrets on it, but it definitely took more time. So
let's talk about what I think we've talked about, or you've said is the easier of the two questions, and that's the legacy of the uprising itself.
Okay.
So let's start there.
Okay, yeah. I mean, they're both huge questions, right? And that's probably the bigger one, honestly. But I guess personally, I feel like the uprising did, well, I mean, the most immediate, obvious thing is that it made it so that any rally you organize looks like it has a small turnout, which is sort of frustrating. But I think one of the big things it did was really activate a lot of new people. And by new people, certainly a lot of young people, but also a lot of older folks who had never really engaged in any kind of protest or activism or organizing or anything like that. And there were a lot of people, I mean, I still meet people regularly who, if you know, you ask, how'd you kind of get started in all of this, will cite the uprising, you know, and the events that surrounded it. Like, that's where they kind of got their start. And some of those people are now, like, superstar organizers and are doing all kinds of things with different organizations and really moving changed forward on a number of fronts. So I think it really injected quite a lot of energy and got a lot of people, got their feet wet and really inspired them to develop in that capacity. So I think that is actually a huge thing, which will have ripple effects and repercussions for many years, I think. Although it'll probably be harder and harder to figure out exactly what they are, it's one of those things that you know, we may end up with some very important historical figures that got their start in the uprising. I would not be too surprised. So I think that's huge. It also strengthened community. I think the sense of community and of common identity among, well, at least a lot of people who were involved. And there's, you know, we have some shared memories of how it felt. And there's something about being in a large group that is really all pushing for something similar, especially with the kind of, I mean, you see this, I think, in a lot of, cultures across the world, anyway, places in a lot of religious ceremonies and other types of sports events, what have you, where you'll have people coming together and all oftentimes cheering or yelling or singing or whatever it is together and having this real sense of being bigger than yourself, being some part of something bigger. And for folks that had never experienced that before, I think it was something that I've heard a number of people comment on, that that was really powerful and kind of changed how they thought about the world, or at least, you know, changed their viewpoint. And for those of us who had experienced something like that before, I think this was bigger than what we'd experienced. At least that was true for me. This was like a whole new level. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that that sort of perspective changing is really important too, because we live in a very individualistic culture in general. Like the media and a lot of the messages we hear on a daily basis and see on a daily basis are very much focused on us as individuals, an individual accomplishment or individual failure or, you know, whatever. And we tend to get separated from each other by our technology and by how the work environment is structured and just lots of different ways, right? And having something that allows you to kind of come together and feel that collective energy is really powerful. And I think it really can change your life in a lot of ways. And I again, it's hard to quantify it, but I think the uprising had a big effect that way on a lot of people. Yeah, so do you want me to go on to personally, or should I keep talking about this?
Let's then move to the other sort of we've talked, you know, uprising writ large. Now, how about uprising and its effects on you particularly? Okay.
Well, I guess personally, I certainly met a good number of people in the course of the uprising and in its aftermath that I had not known before. And a lot about making positive change in the world is, for better or for worse, about who you know and who you can kind of pick up the phone and call, and who's got your back because they know you when things get rough. And so that's been really valuable, just the network of people that I, you know, got to know during the uprising. I think it actually changed something about my identity too, honestly. I mean, I'd been living here for a number of years before the uprising. And so, I mean, I felt like I'm not originally from Wisconsin, but I'd already felt like I lived here, this is my home. But this, I think it did make me more, like the being a person from Wisconsin or in Wisconsin or whatever, living here, being here, that became much more a part of my identity, I think, or at least I think there was a change. A sense of pride about Wisconsin and the people of Wisconsin and being one of them. So I think that changed. And just like a sense of solidarity with a lot of the people, you know, that were involved in that. And just, again, this sense of being part of a larger, meaningful effort that involved other people. So I think all of that, it wasn't, for me, I didn't run out and get like a state of Wisconsin with the solidarity fist tattooed on my arm like a good number of the Capitol community crowd did. And I'm not, I think it's awesome they did. Like those are some really nice tattoos, actually. I think they're beautiful and all that. But I mean, I didn't do that, right? but inside it did change me. I think even if I don't have a, you know, external mark to show for it, I definitely think that internally I have some of that. It also, honestly, just strengthened my own personal resolve to keep fighting back against injustice because, I mean, and I don't know if this is something, I don't think this is something that came out of the uprising, but it just, I mean, obviously you can't go through something like that and not be affected by it, and I certainly am no exception to that. And I think that history is unpredictable, it twists and it turns, and you can't necessarily predict in which direction it's going to go, although you can certainly try to, you know, make things turn the way that you think is right and in the direction of justice and the direction of something better. And there's a lot of examples, you know, in history certainly, where it's been an organized movement of people that have been a critical ingredient in turning things in the right direction. And those effects don't always happen immediately. They don't always happen when the most people are out in the street. A lot of times they'll happen down the line. When people who were involved in that then take that to the next level, get involved in policy discussions, do other things, maybe more behind the scenes or whatever it is, continue organizing, and down the line can end up
making things better. And so I think that, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's kind of how things go in this particular little story. And I'm happy to have been a part of it. I think I feel very blessed, or what the word is, you know, very fortunate to have had the opportunity to experience that firsthand. And I don't know, I guess it just gave me some hope that even though things have not been so good recently from my perspective politically, that I do think it, you know, as the saying says, even though technically it may or may not be true, but it does say, like, things are darkest before the dawn, right? And when things look really dark, they may end up becoming lighter later, and I think that a lot of times they become lighter because people will push in that direction. And so I guess that's maybe so I'll end there. I don't know, unless you have some additional questions.
I think that's a pretty nice place to end.
Okay.
So I think we've done it. I think this ends the oral history. So thank you, Kaya, for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.